Hallo ihr Lieben, herzlich willkommen bei Fair und Female, dem Gesellschaftspodcast der Kleinen Zeitung. Mein Name ist Barbara Haas, ich bin Journalistin und hoste diesen Podcast und heute geht es um feministische Außenpolitik, es geht um sexuelle Gewalt gegen Frauen auf dieser Welt und es geht darum, wie Frauen in Zukunft Gesellschaft mitgestalten können. Und ich freue mich sehr, dass sie heute in Wien ist. Sie ist eine sozialdemokratische Politikerin, war von 2014 bis 2019 Außenministerin von Schweden und auch viele Jahre Vizepräsidentin der Europäischen Kommission. Und sie hat den Begriff der feministischen Außenpolitik quasi erfunden. Herzlich willkommen, Margot Wallström.
Danke sehr.
So, we switch to English because it's better for the conversation. Ms. Wallström, before we get in this feminist foreign policy topic you shaped, I would like to start with a topic that has been on my mind for many years, namely sexual violence against women, which you yourself have been campaigned against for many years. What is your view today on this issue? What's the situation of the world right now for women?
It is a very serious situation for women. And the number of cases of sexual violence against women in war and conflict has risen by 50% in just a few years. So we have not managed to fight this. And it's really a global scourge. And I was, as you well know, I was appointed the first special representative of the Secretary General to work on these matters in 2010. And I learned that there are three misconceptions about this. The first is that this is seen as inevitable because it has been part of every war and conflict since time eternal. And therefore, some tend to think that this is, you know, what a war brings with it, and like collateral damage. Of course, this is not true. It can be commanded, condoned, or condemned. So this is important to know. The second misconception is that this has something to do with sex. That it's kind of a lust that has to come out and that it does so in war and conflict. As a matter of fact, this is about power, exercising power, and it has a sexual expression. It is not the other way around. Mm-hmm. And therefore, in some countries and cultures, it's kind of taboo to talk about it. But I think that we've managed to put it on the political agenda as well, and that is progress. The third misconception is that this is a lesser crime. It is seen as a lesser crime. It has even been used as an argument of defense in some war trials where one of these commanders who stood accused of sexual violence or raping women, he said, "But I could have killed her." So he looked at it as a lesser crime, and therefore he should be it should be condoned, and this is of course something that has such a deep imprint on a person, the effect on a person. On a family, on a village, on a whole country, and I would say on peace and security. Mm-hmm. And this is why it is so important. And I met with so many survivors, and really it was from talking to them that I decided that this has to be part of foreign policy. Because if women are not then later on in a process, in a peace negotiation, then these crimes... it will continue, the impunity for these crimes will continue unless women are there around the tables where peace negotiations take place.
And if we look something to a topic that also changed the world for a moment, maybe, was in 2017, the Me Too movement. Yeah. So many women... spoke out loud what happened to them, but did this movement change anything?
Of course, I think it scared a lot of them. There was a scare, but it was not really effective in the way that you look at why do men think that they can do this to women? Why is there so much violence against women? Where does this come from? And for example, the role of pornography, or, you know, going deeper, looking at also the power situation between men and women was never really discussed. Mm. But it was just looking at how it comes out sort of on the surface. And I think it was a very important movement and a very important phase in history where women have to dare to say that, you know, don't touch me, and this is my body, I decide for myself. Mm-hmm. And of course to fight violence against women, but this is also something, it's a phenomenon that is global and still a huge problem. And also very often peace does not mean peace for women. When soldiers come home from war, and we have so many wars going on, when they come home, we know that there is an increase in violence against women, because violence is what they have been taught. Violence mm-hmm. is what has worked. Mm-hmm. And so it's a very, very serious situation right now.
And would you think it's always the same mechanism working in workplace or in war, or in civil society in general, that this is an instrument of power?
Yes, to a certain extent. And then this can be, of course, it can be part of a scenario, a ritual, or a culture that is created in a war situation, for example. I mean, but it has many, many different, takes many different shapes and forms. And this, we have learned more about sexual violence in war and conflict as well. Mm-hmm. So of course you can end up with a commander who says, I will not allow this to happen under my watch. I will not allow this. I will punish everybody. There, you know, this will not be met with impunity. And in other contexts and situations, this is like, go ahead, it's okay, you do what you like. Mm-hmm. This is an expression of us having conquered also the women, and we take your women from you.
Yes.
So this is kind of the attitude or the mindset that can also change how it is shaped.
But do you see actually some kind of this mindset in the mind of the current leaders?
Misogyny you can find in all of these autocrats. Mm. Why do they start by making sure that legislation hits the rights of women in particular? This is where they start to exercise control.
Mm. If you allow, I want to go a little in your personal biography. You yourself had also personal experience with sexual harassment, and you have spoken publicly in your autobiography. So this was has taken place at a dinner party. What do you remember when you think today in this situation back years?
Well, you always know afterwards exactly what you should have done. In this case, of course, I could have lifted that man's hand and said, you know, hello, whose hand is this? You mm-hmm. know, if you had wanted to do something spectacular. But you are just, you feel totally crushed mm-hmm. when these things happen. And it's important to tell somebody. To go and talk to somebody. I did that as well. When
and how long
this particular
incident to you?
That happened almost immediately. I went to my boss and mm-hmm. said, you know, this happened to me, and at least he listened. I don't think that he actually did anything afterwards, but he listened, and he I felt that there was a kind of understanding, but I don't think that he actually intervened in any way.
But you felt strong enough to tell somebody that this, this so
I
you
left the mm-hmm. place, you know, mm-hmm. and this was around a dinner table or a, you know, we were seated for a meal and mm-hmm. somebody.
Because many women don't are able to tell something that
I know it's important to find somebody to tell,
and then often they tell somebody, and the man or the woman or the society doesn't believe that it happened right now. So what was your power to know what happened and also to be strong enough to tell somebody, because you know, of course, that was not okay.
Yeah, I think it was also anger, you know, really, that I got so angry and so upset. You know, how can this man carry such a and sit on such a position and then do this to a woman and a person that is a colleague? And so I was really angry, and I think that this is also, many women feel shame over being angry, showing anger, but maybe we should just be, you know, furious now and then and just scream or whatever and mm-hmm. just sort of make sure that everybody knows that this is happening. Mm-hmm. And I also remember reading about, you know, all the cases with Weinstein mm-hmm. and all of that in the U.S. And I read about one actress that he had also sort of attacked. And she had told him that, you know what, I don't want to have anything to do with you. And I'm willing to pay the price of not being given any roles in your movies, because this is totally unacceptable. And she just left, stormed out and left. Because I will not take this from anyone. Mm-hmm.
And of course, the price is high. Yeah.
That's what I mean, that most of us understand that it's a high price to pay. Because first of all, that they won't believe you. Often these cases happen where nobody else is watching. You know, you are alone with a person. But still, I think it is very, very important both to be able to maybe mobilize that fury mm-hmm. and that anger, and then also tell somebody else mm-hmm. and get
yeah.
some help.
That's a good advice. But speaking of Weinstein, did you also know or follow the media that the verdict against Weinstein may be overturned because his lawyers are trying to achieve this?
Well, why am I not surprised to hear that? But this is so, yeah, it's so sad.
But he's still in jail because
that's where they belong.
Mm. Okay. Last point to this topic. In Austria, 1 in 5 women experience sexual assault in the course of her life. In your opinion, what would be the most effective methods to getting this issue under control? To be furious in anger?
Well, I mean, this is really about the different roles that we are given in society. I believe that this is why I argue for feminism. And feminism means, if you look it up, it says that it's the idea that men and women should enjoy the same rights, the same obligations, the same opportunities. Mm-hmm. This is what it means, that we should know that we have those rights, and we have a right to decide over our own bodies. We have a right to feel free and make life choices like men. So I think that more of gender equality and economic equality will help women. So of course, and then we have to support each other and give each other strength and help and assistance when needed as well. We have always done so, and we have to continue to do that.
Okay, so let's move to foreign policy.
But can I say one more thing?
Yeah,
of course. I know that this is so sensitive to people to talk about pornography, but I do believe that this is a root cause of a lot of violence against women now. And you know, now in Sweden, there is a debate about strangulation during sex. Mm-hmm. Where do you think that comes from? It comes from pornography. This is where, you know, how is this even possible? But young girls think that they have to accept this. And it's always that, it's always the girls. It's mm-hmm. never the other way around. Mm-hmm. And I think that we really have to think carefully about the fact that most, as young as 8 years old, a lot of boys, especially boys, the majority boys, have already watched pornography. And most of the pornography of today is very, very violent. Mm-hmm. It's more and more violent and perverse and strange.
And available.
Because, and available, yeah, in a few seconds. Mm.
And what is the discussion in Sweden right now about this topic?
Well, I think they're just looking for what can be done. Can you sort of prohibit this particular thing? But I don't know. I haven't seen any. Mm-hmm. There are some proposals for looking at ways to make it illegal. I don't know if that is, mm-hmm. is possible.
But. Because I'm sure you watched it, the series Adolescence, yeah. and this had consequences mm-hmm. for the British government because they start to educate boys in case of how to deal with girls and how to deal with to be not the one picked by a girl or so this was a shocking movie or a shocking series, but it had a point that was also leading the politicians right.
Yeah, it triggered a reaction, a political reaction as well, and it's just so sad that it takes all of that until before you actually deal with these problems. But there are a number of elements here that are important, that of course parents cannot just let children be online and do whatever, and they never check on exactly what they are looking at or what kind of contacts or what kind of impressions they get. And I also think that school, education has a very important role to play. I can also mention another example because I learned from talking to Afghan women friends, and they told me now that what is happening in Afghanistan, where women really have been stripped of all their sort of legal rights, mm-hmm. human rights, they see that more and more of these madrasas are the religious schools. Mm-hmm. And they are for boys. So boys are sent there earlier and earlier, taken from their mothers, taken from their sisters and their family, and put in these madrasas, and where they are given a religious sort of upbringing and training. And it means that they have no contact with women or girls. And they become strange creatures that they don't know what to do with. And it just sort of make them more and more remote from being in a society and being with women. So of course this is where you also nurture misogyny mm-hmm. and the idea that with women you can do whatever and also and, kill them.
And do you think this is the agenda behind this sort of
I think this is how separation? This is how the Taliban will keep their reign. This is how they will steer society, continue to
create their guided power. Soldiers.
Yes, mm-hmm. exactly. Wow. Very, very serious. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Just one question, because we are talking in Austria and all in other countries, a social media ban for kids or young adults to the age of 16, 14 or something like that, Australia. Tries it also. What is your point of view of this?
Well, I think we've come to a point where, and this has been measured, of course, and studied in so many countries, where so many hours per day youngsters spend on social media and spend with their computers or with their smartphones. And of course, this time that could be spent being just outdoors or learning to live in a society or being with others and learn to how to socialize or mm-hmm. to study or to do something that is meaningful for a good life. So I think it's a kind of a desperation that we have not been able to control this or steer it so that it is sort of manageable. And that it doesn't hurt young people, but when it's so dominant as it is in today's world, I think, yeah, why not try? See if we can regulate it or limit these hours at least.
But maybe the ban should go to the tech companies, not to the personnel.
And parents as well. Because, you know, parents spend also a lot of time.
Okay, so... let's move to foreign policy. You coined this term feminist foreign policy more than, I think, 10 years ago. But what exactly do you mean by this term, feminist foreign policy?
Well, it's driven by the insight and the understanding that there cannot be lasting peace, durable peace, if women are not part of peace processes. So, and we know that from the little research that has been done, particularly by the United Nations, that these peace agreements, where women are among the signatories, they last longer, and more options are brought onto the table where you discuss peace. So it belongs to foreign policy from that point of view. And then I did not want to make it an identity politics. I said that the parameters by which we will work on this and through the diplomatic presence around the world is by looking at rights, representation and resources. Do women enjoy and girls enjoy the same right? Can they open a bank account? Can they start a business? Can they go to school? Can they not be married away when they are 14? All of those rights that should belong also to girls and women. The representation, are they there? Are they around the tables where important decisions are being made in parliaments and governments and so on, in companies, in boards of big companies? Are women there? And thirdly, also, what about the budgets? So are budgets designed in order to meet the needs of women and girls as well? And does money go to that? And it starts with knowing, you know, having the statistics or gender-based budgeting and so on. Many countries still don't have that.
Mm-hmm. But when we look at our world today, and also even close to Austria, the Russians' war against the Ukraine, this kind of foreign policy seems without a feminist approach. But the US President Donald Trump and also Russian President Vladimir Putin are concerned with other values, as far as I see. So economic interests and power demonstration. So where do you see, or on which point are we in the war situation in the Ukraine from this point of view, that women should be part of the table, part of the negotiations, part of the peace plans?
I've thought a lot about that. And of course, women, Ukrainian women, they also fight with men. They are on the battlefield. Many of them have taken up weapons because they want to defend their country and themselves and their families and their life and their country. So they are there on the battlefield. But a majority of women, they have had to either leave the country or stay and take care of the elderly, take care of children. Who is supposed to do that if women don't? So they are given a different role. And this was exactly what Resolution 1325, the resolution that the United Nations adopted and that became a mother resolution for understanding that both war and peace affects men and women differently. Mm-hmm. And those women that had to leave, that have come to this country or to my country, if their stories are not heard, one day when peace will hopefully come and peace agreements will have to be made and the sum up of all of these hostilities and the suffering from war, if their voices are not heard, if they cannot share what they have endured and what they have experienced, there will not be peace for women. Because women are also more exposed to trafficking, being victims of trafficking or sexual violence in war and conflict. So I'm just saying that it's not only those that carry a gun and a uniform and are out there in the battlefield, but also all the others that suffer and sometimes die, not in war, but from, being on the front line in many ways. And that's the experience of women, and that has to be part of any process. Mm-hmm. Let's see where it goes, because, you know, I know that this is easy to say, and we've had this resolution for so long, but also when the peace agreement was made in Ethiopia about Tigray, no women were around the table. And one of the things that was most discussed was actually the rapes. Mm-hmm. But women were not there. They were not represented. They did not have a voice in those negotiations. So what happens? Yeah, impunity continues for these crimes, and their stories are not heard, and the peace will be much more fragile. Mm-hmm.
But do you see some light in this in this conflict, in this war, where this the stories and the positions?
Yes, I do. Because it's in many ways it's both the most archaic war we can imagine. You know, like we have these tanks and the trenches and mm-hmm. the things that we've seen from World War One and Two. You know, it's the same, but it's also the most modern. We can collect evidence like never before. We can see the videos sent in real time. We can follow what goes on in the battlefield, the suffering of all these people, all these the manifestations, all the facts that have been brought to life through modern technology will help us a lot. And I think that especially women are so good at that. And I of course read Ukrainian newspapers, and I look at their films and everything. They can do that, so we can see it as it happens. And that is important, because it cannot be ignored, and it can also be used to create accountability for these war crimes. So I think it will help. But as always, women have to come together to make sure that you know, their interests are taken into account and that their stories are being heard. Mm-hmm. They have voices, but somebody has to listen to them as well.
Yeah, and you also have to have the resources to come together to practice solidarity. It's not so easy if you struggle with your own daily life.
Correct. And this is why it is important to support civil society, to make sure that you have a bigger picture when you look at what goes on also in Ukraine. You can give women's organizations the means to work on these matters, and they do. They are amazing. They are absolutely fantastic in coming together, in defending the most valuable things, and they care about the social weave that they have also in Ukraine. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I'm hopeful, because I think that the people and women will continue, but they are under heavy pressure at the moment. Really, everywhere in the world, women are affected by all these wars, and they end up being squeezed from all corners.
The European Union has no place in this fragile negotiations about maybe peace in Ukraine, because there is just Russia and the U.S. So what is your point? What is your view? What do you see? What is the role of the European Union in this conflict?
No, I mean, the European Union has the most important role in one way, because really it is the membership of the European Union that is a driver, a motivation for Ukraine. It also has created this move to make sure that they live up to the acquis communautaire in different areas. They work very, very hard on that, but also that EU countries and the European Commission has been so supportive throughout, has been there. And of course, now the discussion is what to do with the frozen assets. And I really think that they just quickly have to find a way to make sure that the Ukrainians can use the frozen assets.
Because this is Russian money that is frozen, and this could be power for just the weapons or just going on in this war. And do you think that will happen?
I think so. I think they will find a way, even if it is they will find a legal construction that is acceptable without sort of touching international law in a way that can be detrimental to the European Union and banks in the future. But this is what they are working on at the moment. I think so.
Also a topic, you know, maybe we go to the UN celebration. The United Nations are celebrating 80 years since they were founded. But they are... Are the United Nations still this peace-taking institution and this moral compass of the world? What do you think about it?
Well, at the global level, what else do we have if not the United Nations? And I think it is important to have a sort of clear-headed view of where the United Nations is today, to both recognize all the kind of successes and the achievements of the United Nations over these years, but also see that it is a very fragile and not fully functioning organization today. When it is the most needed, because I mean, we have all of these existential threats, we have the wars going on, we have still so much of poverty and suffering in the world, and we want the UN to work better, and especially for small countries like our two countries. You know, we need the United Nations, because otherwise it is really a principle of might is right. In the world. So do we want these autocrats ruling the biggest countries in the world? Do we want them to decide everything for us? And where does democracy go? Because it is still the convening power of the United Nations must not be underestimated. And still there are, I think, 19 peacekeeping operations around the world. So look at all the UN organizations, UN bodies that are there to help the people who suffer around the world, from UNICEF to the World Health Organization or the courts that have been installed. But of course, the fact that the Security Council has been unable to deal with today's big conflicts and wars has hurt the trust sort of in this organization, and the veto power, it just has to change, and it has to be made more representative, more effective, and so on. And that work is going on. So I can see all the flaws and so on, but I also think that we have to recognize that without it, we would be in a very, very difficult situation, a much more difficult situation.
But on the other hand, people vote for right-wing parties. Also in Austria, the FPÖ, the right-wing party, has in the polls the 35% or something like that, and would be the winner of the next election for sure. And the UN is not part of this shift in society. So the same in Germany, the same in the US. So it's going to, maybe because of this world is so complex today and so hard to have a good view in it. But how can the UN power and also the secure power really manifest in this fragile world?
We need stronger leaders from the United Nations as well. You know, in the organization, we need leaders that we can really trust and that are strong enough to sort of lead the organization into the future. We need it to be. We have to deal with the Security Council and the fact that it was actually during the Russian presidency of the Security Council that they invaded a neighboring country, namely Ukraine. Mm. So that happened under their time being in the chair of the Security Council. So in total breach of the UN Charter. So of course that hurts the organization. But I also met with this. I go back to Afghanistan because I think it's just a screaming example of where things have gone so wrong. But we were talking about this, and some Afghan sisters were in that room, and they said, you cannot complain so much about the UN. If the UN was not there in our country, we would have nothing. We would have absolutely nothing. They are the only ones left in our country of the international community. Nobody else has ever come to our help if it were not for the United Nations. So remember that sometimes, you know, that this is, the UN will be there. The UN will try to provide food or shelter or help to people. But I don't have all the answers. I know that there is a reform. I wish I had, but yeah. I mean, there is a reform, a thinking about reforming the UN and proposals on the table. So the Secretary General himself has also presented a program. And it means that you merge some of the UN bodies. It means that you move the UN bodies out of New York to other places in the world, cheaper and more effective and slimmed down. And I think a lot of it is very good. It's necessary to do that. But this is also because the world has not, and the US has not paid, has not helped with the budget and the funding of the UN. So of course it will be weaker, but it is really also for us, the smaller countries, we lose the most if we lose the UN. And the fact that so many of the things that now we refer back to are resolutions or conventions that the UN has decided on. The convention on the it was mentioned yesterday, the sea, and of course for a landlocked country this is no sort of thing, but to all other countries that have, you know, that we are dependent on what happens in the seas. And there is a convention steering what you can do and not do. We have the resolution 1325 that has shaped our understanding, and we act upon that. All other important conventions and laws that has been adopted by the United Nations, or the climate change framework as well.
So we should give the United Nations results maybe more credit in the discussion.
Yeah, as I said, clear-headed and recognize that this is actually what helps all of us to act in a decent way towards each other, both small and big countries. We all depend on that, having some, you know, a rules-based order that we like, because if not, it is the big ones that will take over. And I think this is also very serious for democracy, because this is where we meet and make decisions together. And most countries now live in countries that go back, most people live in countries that go backwards from a democratic point of view.
Yeah. Okay.
So we have solved all the world's problems.
Yeah, we have solved everything. So we can go home and have a sleep. Ms. Weiström, thank you so much for being with me and with us.
Dankeschön. And good luck to you. And thank you for having me on your program.
Of course, sehr gerne. Und bei euch sage ich auch ganz lieben Dank fürs Dabeisein. Diesmal ein Gespräch auf Englisch. Ich gebe es euch aber auch noch als Transkript in die Shownotes. Und wenn ihr wollt, dann hören wir uns wieder nächste Woche. Bis dahin alles Liebe und Baba.